Technology, it's making me a bit nervous. I'm a laryngologist, and so being in the room with a bunch of rhinologists, anyway, got me on edge. But I'd like to, again, welcome everybody. Thank you for coming. I just want to remind everybody that the resident bowl will be immediately following this session at 12:45. Please make every effort to attend. I think I was speaking, I was speaking with Dave Bars yesterday. We may have six or seven resident teams. Then I'd like to remind everybody about the Meet the Authors poster reception at 6:30 this evening. And then lastly, please complete your evaluation forms on Sunday to receive CME credit and certification. Thank you, everybody, for attending.
You want to go?
Yeah.
Thank you again and welcome. I'd like to start with the first paper. Immunodeficiency is common in patients refractory chronic rhinosinusitis by Dr. Davis. Just come up.
Try to keep the time, 7 minutes, right?
7 minutes.
Hi, I'm Kara Davis. I'm a resident at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Thank you for having me start off this session on our series of immunodeficiency in patients with refractory rhinosinusitis. Our disclosures, Dr. Ferguson is our senior author. She's a member of the advisory committee for Meta and Teva Pharmaceuticals. Excuse me, and she also performs research as a panelist. So for our series, how do we define refractory and recurrent chronic rhinosinusitis? So in our tertiary care referral center, we describe this as having multiple physician visits, repeated courses of antibiotics, marked symptomatology, specifically including a decreased sense of smell, and then documented recurrence of acute sinusitis with a minimum of 3 episodes per year. What we know. So we know that immunodeficiency contributes to refractory chronic rhinosinusitis. We know that there is some contribution of the innate immune system as well as the adapted immune system. And probably the combination and interplay of the two is the biggest factor in this disease. But what we don't know is the prevalence and clinical characteristics. So our objective was to assess the prevalence and clinical characteristics of undiagnosed immunodeficiency in these patients. So this is a retrospective review of a prospectively collected cohort driven by the EMR in this very specific tertiary academic sinonasal disorders clinic. Excuse me, we performed an assessment of immunologic and clinical parameters in consecutively accrued patients from 2010 to 2012 mid-year. Our inclusion criteria were the following. So failed management by a referring otolaryngologist, including multiple antibiotic trials, or 3 or more acute sinonasal infections treated with antibiotics and or steroids in the 12 months preceding referring presentation to our clinic. Our exclusion criteria include transplant, granulomatous disorders, cystic fibrosis, malignancy, immunosuppressive medications such as Enbrel, and previously diagnosed immunodeficiency. This is an example of a chart. So we use EPIC in our outpatient clinics. This is pulled forward each visit. This is in our panel here, so CBC, and then we include it consecutively on visits. Eosinophils, CD4, CD8 count, 16 and 56 for natural killer cells. We calculate a helper-suppressor ratio. Pneumococcal titers, and then post-pneumovax pneumococcal titers if it's prompted by this here being low. We do immunoglobulins and then subclasses of IgG. IgE as well as a complement assay. And then in the past 6 months, we've added mannose-lectin binding protein as well as a diphtheria toxoid, which is not included in this report. So we started with 133 patients. 38 of these were excluded. The majority of these were excluded because when reviewing their charts or outside records, they actually had some previous diagnosis of immunodeficiency the patient just wasn't aware of. 2 of our patients had cystic fibrosis and 2 had Wegener's. in reviewing the charts, and then 7 didn't complete testing. Of our 95 patients that were included in this report, 64% of them, so 61, had some form of immunodeficiency. The patients were similar with regard to age, their gender, although predominant, almost 60% female predominance in both groups. The number of surgeries or revisions and the our internal staging for nasal polyps. Patients with a diagnosed immunodeficiency had significantly more infections in the year preceding presentation. This is to highlight the breakdown in the 95 included patients. So 61 of them had some abnormality. And this is a further description of that. So nearly 49%, 48 and change, had an IgG subclass deficiency. The majority of these were IgG2, followed by IgG1, and then a handful of IgG3 and IgG4. 33% of patients had a reduction in one or in more than one gamma globulin, but did not were not low across the board, so they didn't qualify as hypogammaglobulinemia. 10% had a specific antibody deficiency, as indicated on pneumococcal titers, and then a handful were diagnosed with common variable immunodeficiency, IgA deficiency, and complement deficiency. This is the breakdown of our IgG subclasses, so the strong majority were IgG2 deficient. Asthma was more prevalent in the IgG subclasses than other humoral immunodeficiencies. 5 of our patients went on to receive IVIG. 4 of these had significant resolution of symptoms, and 1 was intolerant to treatment. She had a serum sickness-like reaction. The clinical importance of IgG subclass deficiency is debatable, but in our practice, this prompts empiric and quick therapy while awaiting culture results in patients with an identified immunodeficiency. So this is the first study to prospectively examine a cohort, and it is in concordance with previous retrospective studies. The most recent and similar externally to ours is the 2010 Best, Scott Graham, and others. The strengths are that this was a prospective cohort. The obvious limitations is that we have a loose definition of what is refractory chronic rhinosinusitis. We don't have documented verifications of the infections from our referring physicians, and the timing of the testing also wasn't verified of whether or not they were infected or treated. Our patients have a variable exposure to steroids. So I think the most important thing to know moving forward is long-term patient follow-up. If we repeat these panels over and over again, do we get the same results? And then how do these patients do in the long term? As we learn more about secondary immunodeficiencies, those should be considered in these patients as well. We want to thank our patients and their families, as well as our research coordinators. Dr. Marilyn Ferguson is the senior author on the paper, and Dr. Stella Lee is also a contributing senior author. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Davis. The next paper is Predicting Post-Surgery Nasophysiology and Computational Modeling by Dr. Frank Ito from Durham, North Carolina.
Good morning. I'd like to thank the organizers for giving us the opportunity to present our work. As reported in the literature, at least 1 in 4 surgical treatments for nasal obstruction will fail. Therefore, we need better diagnostic tools that can aid with pre-surgical planning. Our objective was to investigate whether computer models based on digital modifications on the pre-CT images can accurately reflect post-surgical changes. This is an IRB-approved study. All subjects had pre- and post-CT images, and virtual surgeries were created based on surgeons' recollection, interpretations, and healing expected after surgery. The patients' ages range from 22 to 53 years, and there were 7 males and 3 females. They all had clinical diagnosis of nasal obstructions and elected to have surgery. This shows the pre-CT image, and the green outline, it's the airspace that were surgically created. The red outline shows the airspace that was surgically closed as a result of moving the septums in this direction. The middle image shows the actual post scan. And what we have on the right is our virtual surgery outline superimposed on the post scan. We see that, you know, it looks quite good, you know, even though it's not perfect. Now, on this image, this shows the septum before surgery. This is the surgical region, and our post septum looks like this. The actual, so our VS septum looks like this, and this is the actual post septum. Looking at the frontal view, you see the magnitude of deviation on the pre. This is what we got using our virtual modifications. And this is what the post looks like. Our expectations are that, you know, the pre should be different from the virtual surgery as well as the post surgery. But we expect our post surgery to be similar to the our VS surgery to be similar to the post. What we see is that for this variable, total nasal resistance, the pre was different from VS and post, which is good, but the VS was different from the post. This is contrary to our expectations. So for some reason, when we looked at bilateral nasal resistance, our virtual surgery did not do a good job predicting the post. We also looked at the unilateral resistance on the predominantly, you know, obstructed side. And what that shows was that what we expected, the VS, the pre should be different from the VS and the post. So that was good. Again, we're happy that, you know, our VS now happens to predict the post for the predominantly obstructed side. So the one thing we could draw out of this result is that for some reason the other side might be confounding our virtual model. But when we now focus on the obstructed side, our VS model did a good job predicting the post. Now this is a description where the target is the straight line. And our goal is to see how the VS models happen to be close to the straight line as possible. The open circles are pre. So comparing total nasal resistance and unilateral nasal resistance, one obvious thing we noticed was that our VS models happen to predict post-surgical outcome on the obstructed side alone compared to the total nasal resistance. We also noticed that the VS models tend to overestimate the benefit of surgery. From this point, they tend to be lower than the line. So that's an indication of, you know, having too much optimism that our virtual surgery is good based on the surgeon's recollection. This shows the average pressure along the nasal cavity, and that's the region of surgery. The gray bar is also the region of surgery. For subject one, we see that the VS and post trended in the same direction. So in essence, for subject one, with regards to average pressure, our model did a very good job trending with the post. Subject two is not very clear because the pre, the post, and the VS are all trending in the same direction. Subject three, our VS model did a very poor job predicting the post. The VS is the green line, and we just did not capture what was happening in the post. Subject four, our VS model did a very great job predicting the post. So some of the challenges we encountered was that it was difficult for the surgeon to translate surgical steps, you know, onto the computer. You know, pretty much he was relying on manual editing 2D multiple CT images. We did not have the opportunity for him to have an endoscopic view like he was experienced during surgery. In our CFD models, we made some assumptions that may have oversimplified our process. In conclusion, we strongly believe that computational models can predict post-surgical outcomes. However, there exist some challenges based on the current technology that limits surgeons' ability to accurately transcribe, perform surgical procedures to the computer. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Ito. The next paper is, do endoscopic findings predict symptoms of sinusitis? The DIP score and sinonasal symptoms by Dr. Burley.
My name is Sheeple Burley. I'm a PGY3 at the University of California, San Francisco. And I'll be presenting my research on a novel nasal endoscopic scoring system called the DIP and its correlation with the SNOT 20 score. I have no disclosures. To provide you with some background information, chronic sinusitis affects about 13% of the U.S. adult population. It commands a significant portion of the healthcare budget today at $8.6 billion per year. Endoscopic nasal examination is routine, and it's a critical part of diagnosing and tracking disease progression in patients with chronic sinusitis. It allows us to directly visualize nasal cavities themselves and assess the amount of disease burden. There's been a significant amount of research done on the various endoscopic scoring systems, and they haven't shown great correlation with patient severity of symptoms. The DIP score is a novel nasal endoscopic scoring system which was created and published in 2012. It assesses the amount of discharge, inflammation, and polyps or edema that's present within the nasal cavity. It's graded on an 11-point Likert scale, and a total score of 30 can be scored per nasal cavity, 30 being a nasal cavity with a lot of disease. In this study, it showed great correlation with current endoscopic scoring systems, including the Len-Kennedy and the POSE scoring system. And of the three scoring systems, the DIP score had the highest test, retest, and inter-rater reliability. In that same study, in a cross-sectional analysis of the patients as a whole, the DIP score and the Len-Kennedy and the POSE scores did not correlate well with the patient's severity of symptoms as expected. It was thought that there was a significant amount of interpatient symptom variability that was thought to contribute to this lack of correlation. The purpose of our study was then to determine whether or not the DIP nasal endoscopic scoring system can predict severity of symptoms as measured by the SNOT 20 score in individual patients over time, thus removing that interpatient symptom variability. So the hypothesis of our study was that a higher DIP score in these patients with chronic sinusitis would predict a higher SNOT 20 score. The design of our study was a retrospective cohort study. All patients in a 2-year period who underwent a nasal endoscopy were included in the study. They must have completed a SNOT 20 questionnaire at the time of the visit. We then excluded all patients who underwent endoscopies for other reasons other than chronic sinusitis or nasal polyposis. We also excluded all patients who underwent nasal endoscopy within 1 month postoperatively. So in total, we had 61 patients who had 2 or more nasal endoscopies, along with a corresponding SNOT 20 score. The SNOT 20 score is a patient-generated sinusitis symptom survey, and it includes 20 relevant items shown here. Each item is scored from 0 to 5, 5 being most bothersome to the patient. The total score is a numerical average of all 20 items. These nasal endoscopy videos that were gathered, they were de-identified, and they were separated into a left and a right nasal cavity video. There were 331 videos in total. They were blinded, they were randomized, and they were presented to our faculty rhinologist. These videos then were scored according to the DIP score shown here, assessing the amount of discharge, inflammation, and polyps or edema. We then calculated a mean DIP score for each one of these videos. The mean DIP score was the average of the left and the right nasal cavity videos, and the max DIP score was calculated to be the higher of the two sides, left or right. We then used a linear mixed effects statistical model to determine if the max DIP or the mean DIP was predictive of the SNOT 20 scores. This is the type of regression model that takes into account different fixed and random effects that are inherent in the chosen independent variable. And it's especially useful in data like this where you have repeated measurements from the same individual over time. We found that the, a 1-point rise in the max DIP score correlated with a rise in the SNOT 20 score by 0.037. This was statistically significant, and notably the confidence interval did not include zero. And similarly, the rise in the mean DIP score by 1 point correlated with the rise in the SNOT 20 score by 0.04. And again, this was statistically significant, and the confidence interval did not include zero. So we essentially found that there was a statistically significant positive correlation between the DIP score and patient-generated SNOT 20 scores. What this means is that the DIP has potential to be utilized in evaluating efficacy of different treatment modalities in patients with chronic sinusitis. There are several limitations in that this was a relatively small sample size done at a single institution. The same clinician who performed the initial nasal endoscopy was the one who reviewed the videos, and there is potential for recall bias. This was mitigated by blinding the videos, randomizing the videos, and then presenting them 1 to 2 years after the videos were initially taken. The majority of these patients were post-op patients, and this data may not be generalizable to patients who have not undergone surgery. So in conclusion, among individual patients, a change in the DIP sinonasal endoscopic scoring system can predict a corresponding change in patient symptoms as measured by the SNOT 20 score. I'd like to thank my mentors and collaborators, Drs. Megan Durr, Andrew Goldberg, Andrew Muir, Stephen Pletcher, and John Kornack.
Thank you. First, if Dr. Hodnett is here, can you please check with the audiovisual technician concerning your presentation? Our next presentation is The Effects of Smoking on Quality of Life Following Sinus Surgery, the 10-year follow-up by Dr. White.
Good morning. Many thanks to the Triological Society for the opportunity to speak today. I'd like to thank my co-authors. There's nothing to disclose.
Could you
Thank you. Reset the timer.
As we all know, chronic rhinosinusitis is a disease that affects a large portion of our population. It costs upwards of $6 billion annually, directly through physician office visits, procedures, and medications, and indirectly through missed employment and productivity. It also causes a reduced quality of life in those affected. The pathophysiology of the disease involves altered mucociliary clearance leading to stasis with subsequent bacterial overload and infection. Any additional insult to the homeostasis can further progress this problem. In individuals prone to chronic rhinosinusitis, smoking can irritate and provoke the already sensitive nasal mucosa. In our experience, we noted improvement in symptom scores in patients with chronic rhinosinusitis who smoke when the disease burden is lessened through endoscopic sinus surgery and postoperative medical regimens. Our previous studies, the effects of smoking on short-term quality of life outcomes in sinus surgery, demonstrated that smokers actually achieved a greater short-term quality of life score compared to non-smokers. The 4-year follow-up showed that both smokers and non-smokers continued to maintain similar improvements in their SNOT 20 scores. The aim of this study was to review the long-term quality of life outcomes in patients after sinus surgery who continue to smoke. Approval for this study was granted by the Georgia Regents University Institutional Review Board, and patients from the previous study who underwent endoscopic sinus surgery at our institution beginning in 2003 were identified. All patients were evaluated with a complete history and physical exam, imaging of the paranasal sinuses, rigid nasal endoscopy, and their symptom scores were quantified with the validated SNOT 20 scores. The original group of patients were contacted via telephone and informed consent was obtained. A scripted patient questionnaire was performed, which investigated smoking status, date of smoking cessation if applicable, and rates of revision surgery since their last visit. Current SNOT 20 scores were obtained via telephone and compared to the pre-op SNOT 20, and statistical analysis was then performed. 22 out of 235, or 94%, of patients were available for the initial short-term follow-up study. 137, or 58%, were available for the four-year study, and we were able to contact 53, or 22.5%, of patients for our 10-year follow-up. This included 43 out of 185 non-smokers, or 23.2%, and 9 out of 50 smokers, or 18%. The average pack years for the smoking group was calculated to be 32 plus or minus 20. Our results are as follows. Demographic data for age, sex, and race was found to be similar between the two patient groups. Revision surgery was not statistically significantly different between the non-smoking and smoking group. And the pre-op, Lund McKay, endoscopy, and SNOT 20 scores were also similar between the two groups. There was a trend towards increased nasal polyposis in the non-smoking group at 39% compared to the smoking group at 11%. However, this did not reach statistical significance. The 10-year SNOT 20 score for the non-smoking group was 31.5 plus or minus 11.5, and for the smoking group, 28.2 plus or minus 16. And again, this was not statistically significant between the two groups. Our previously published data demonstrates that smokers actually have increased, if not similar, quality of life scores relative to the non-smokers, and that successful endoscopic sinus surgery with a postoperative medical regimen for chronic rhinosinusitis can reduce the overall disease burden that the smoker may experience. This study is the longest follow-up to date evaluating quality of life scores in patients with chronic sinusitis who smoke. And our findings indicate that even 10 years out from sinus surgery, postoperative quality of life scores are maintained similarly between the smoking and non-smoking population. These findings further support the previous recommendation that functional endoscopic sinus surgery has long-term benefits for both the smoking and non-smoking population. Thank you.
Our next paper is Standardizing Allergy Practices Through Development of a Central Resource Website in an Academic Otolaryngic Allergy Practice by Dr. Hodnett from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. I'm going to present a project that we've recently completed at the University of Pittsburgh. We performed a systematic review of our allergy practice and made modifications to improve patient care and quality metrics. These are our disclosures. So what is a quality metric? It's a measurement of factors that are associated with good patient-centered care. However, this is not yet well defined in the delivery of allergy immunotherapy. There's a need to develop appropriate metrics to assess and that assess and correlate with patient and safety outcomes. There's also a need to standardize allergy immunotherapy care to eliminate errors in anaphylaxis. What does this mean going forward? Well, with the Affordable Care Act in 2015, there's going to be new provisions that are going to tie physician payments to quality of care provided. In November, Congress passed a compounding bill that is increasing stringency of compounding requirements, and this also will apply to allergy immunotherapy. And then, as I previously mentioned, anaphylaxis and errors are always an important thought in our practice, and even at our own university. In one fiscal year, we had 7 episodes of anaphylaxis, 2 of which were related to dosing errors. So to improve and review our allergy practice, an Allergy Quality Initiative roundtable was convened that included our physicians, technicians, nurses, and managers. I put together a 46-question survey encompassing 7 key categories that was sent out to our 7 allergy technicians and medical assistants over our 6 allergy sites. These satellite sites are primarily based in Pittsburgh, However, there are two that are in the surrounding communities of Pittsburgh and one that is over an hour away. From this survey, we identified five core areas of improvement. These were standardization of training and assessment, reducing errors in mixing, allergy administration, and documentation, as well as a need for ongoing systems review to evaluate our current practice and adhere to existing practice standards and parameters. We also sought to improve communication with our data entry access and relevance of our EMR, as well as improved reporting and review of errors, adverse events, and anaphylaxis. So here are the results from our survey in regards to training. Our allergy technicians noted their mean allergy training was 48 days, and this was high variability from just a few days to up to 2.5 months. This was only found to be adequate by 50% of our respondents, and less than half of our allergy technicians could participate in our biweekly allergy teleconference. Recommendations from our survey from the technicians included improved hands-on teaching, consistency in training, and increased scenario simulations. And the overall recommended training period was recommended to be about 1 month. When we looked at our anaphylaxis data, we found that we were doing quite well. We had a clearly outlined and updated protocol visible in all of our satellite offices. All of our technicians knew where the anaphylaxis cart was located, and the contents of the cart, and this was regularly updated. 100% of our technicians were trained in either BLS or ACLS. However, not everyone was formally trained in anaphylaxis management. When it came to allergy testing and mixing, our technicians reported several problems. They found that 57% noted a lack of protected time to perform their allergy testing, and two-thirds noted that they were frequently distracted or even having distractions occur throughout their work day. And more importantly, there was errors in mixing noted by 57% of our respondents, and this was related to multitasking during mixing or documentation errors. Our technicians also noted that only half of our technicians noted there was an adequate mechanism to even report an error or a near miss. So in response to these problems, we put forth several things to address individual concerns. First, starting with training, I developed five web-based allergy training modules with the help of our Physician Services Division. These were put forth along with the annual compliance training so that the technicians could take them on an annual basis, and these have been reviewed multiple times to ensure their accuracy and that they're continually up to date. We also added at our biweekly allergy conference an anaphylaxis review so that at least twice a week everyone that's participating in the conference can review anaphylaxis and what to do in these situations. And at all of our satellite clinics, mock anaphylaxis drills have been put in place. For our allergy administration, we now at all our satellites have a centralized allergy testing area where all the vial mixing is done. There's protected mixing time that's reinforced and supported by our administration. And prior to administration of any of the shots, two-person patient vial verification is performed, and vial testing is started on patients receiving an injection from a new vial. We also modified our EMR system to allow improved access to allergy patient information. On the screen from the EMR, all the information is present in one area so that it's readily accessible. And this project originally started with the Central Resource website, and we put this forth so that all the technicians at all of the sites could access it. We built in calendar functions, documentation lists, and included in these I put in patient forms and resources that are routinely used by our technicians, as well as resource materials such as allergy practice standards. We put in all of our allergy protocols so that the technicians at all the sites had access to things that could be updated over time. And I also built in a database where we could centralize reporting of our errors and adverse events. So in conclusion, we performed a systematic review of our academic otolaryngic practice. We identified multiple areas for quality improvement. We put forth a standardization of allergy training and assessment, and instituted several new protocols to reduce errors and adverse events. Future directions include assessing our efficacy of our allergy treatment on our patient outcomes by, you know, again, reviewing our errors and anaphylaxis rates, and then resurveying our allergy technicians and medical assistants to see how they've responded to our changes in training and the improvement in allergy shot mixing, testing, and administration. Thank you.
Our next paper is entitled Inferior Meatus Endoscopy with Directed Treatment for Epiphora, Long-Term Follow-Up and Development of a Treatment Paradigm by Dr. Durain.
Good morning. Thank you, Dr. Goldberg and Dr. Kuntakis, members and guests, for the opportunity to present here today. We have no financial disclosures. So epiphora is a very common complaint that presents to the ophthalmologist and the otolaryngologist. And this can be due to obstruction along the entire nasal lacrimal system, starting up at the puncta or the canaliculi and all the way down to the inferior meatus. Thorough evaluation is important for the etiology of the epiphora, and it requires collaboration between the ophthalmologist and the otolaryngologist because each one of these subspecialties has something specific and unique to offer. So once the etiology is identified, treatment can begin, and this can start with NLD irrigation. It can also be through dilation of the puncta or the canaliculi, or more advanced techniques such as DCR, and this can be done in an open or endoscopic manner. It's long been considered the gold standard, and it can relieve obstruction only by bypassing any sort of pathology at or below the level of the nasolacrimal sac by creating an outflow tract. An inferior meatus endoscopy with a directed surgical treatment can also be performed, and this will be the emphasis of my talk today. So what is it about the inferior meatus that can cause obstruction? So the nasal lacrimal duct orifice cysts have been described in adults before. Dr. Delgadio described three in 2007, and Eloy described three again in 2012. And this can be treated through direct IM surgery to relieve the obstruction. And up here you can see this structure, the cystic structure here, and then again right down here on the CT scan. So once we noted these cysts, we started doing routine endoscopy of the inferior meatus in the office. We published a paper in 2009 detailing our experiences with inferior meatus endoscopy and directed treatment for epiphora. 18 total sites were operated on. Of these 18, 14 were distal, and of these 14, 13 had resolution or dramatic improvement of epiphora after surgery. The remaining four sites were proximal extension of disease, and only one of these had improvement of symptoms. The rest required DCRs. The median follow-up here was 9 months. So we took this a step further, and that's the purpose of our study, and that was to report on long-term outcomes in patients who underwent directed treatment of the inferior meatus for epiphora. In other words, we wanted to determine if the short-term improvement was maintained. And we also wanted to propose a paradigm, for diagnosis and management of patients with epiphora. The way we did this was through a retrospective chart review of patients who presented with epiphora, and we characterized this as either distal or proximal nasolacrimal duct disease. And then we performed a follow-up phone survey to assess for long-term outcome. We asked for subjective improvement or resolution of epiphora from these patients. So 17 patients in total were surveyed, totaling 23 nasolacrimal systems. Of these, 13 patients responded, which totaled 18 nasolacrimal systems. One patient was excluded because her pathology was due to CLL, and this was systemic disease that also infiltrated the entire nasolacrimal duct system. An operation was not expected to improve her symptoms. 16 total nasolacrimal systems remained, 10 of which were distal and 6 which were proximal. The mean follow-up in our study was 5.6 years in contrast to the 9 months of the previous study. Of the distal obstructions, which there were 10 of, 9 had long-term successes and only 1 failed and required DCR. For proximal obstruction, there were 6 nasolacrimal systems and 1 was a long-term success. The rest, the other 5, were failures and required DCR. So what does all this mean? So we'll start with inferior meatus pathology. So it's a very common cause to have inferior meatus pathology at the NLD orifice in patients with the PIFRA, but more importantly, the otolaryngologist can easily identify this with routine inferior meatus endoscopy in the office. Our initial report showed very good results in distal pathology for inferior meatus surgery, but not too good for proximal pathology. As this is the data that I showed you earlier, we had distal obstruction with improvement in almost 93% of patients and proximal obstruction with only improvement in 25%. With our data, which was long-term, improvement was seen with distal nasolacrimal duct pathology after inferior meatus surgery at a rate of 90% for distal and only 16.7% for proximal. The important thing here is that recognizing distal versus proximal pathology allows for better treatment decisions to be made, and as a result, better outcomes for the patient after inferior meatus surgery. So now for the diagnostic and treatment paradigm that we developed. When the patient initially presents with a PIFRA in the otolaryngologist's office, evaluation is done by IM endoscopy. If the inferior meatus or the nasolacrimal duct orifice is abnormal, indicating distal disease, inferior meatus treatment in the OR can be done. However, if the nasolacrimal duct orifice is normal, then a referral to ophthalmology is warranted. In the ophthalmologist's office, irrigation can be done, and if the irrigation flows freely, then no treatment of the inferior meatus is necessary, and we should consider later punctal pathology. However, if the irrigation doesn't reach the inferior meatus or high pressure is necessary, then referral back to otolaryngology is necessary for inferior meatus evaluation and subsequent surgery. Now, once the otolaryngologist takes the patient to the operating room, he or she can perform irrigation with simultaneous endoscopy. And if OR irrigation doesn't reach the inferior meatus, this indicates proximal pathology and a DCR is warranted at this point. However, if there's ballooning of the nasolacrimal duct orifice or the lateral wall of the inferior meatus, or if irrigation reaches the inferior meatus but requires significant force, this indicates distal disease, and inferior meatus-directed treatment should be performed in the operating room. However, if during this operation proximal pathology is noted, then a DCR might be needed. So in conclusion, inferior meatus endoscopy with directed treatment is an effective alternative to DCR for distal nasolacrimal duct obstructions with sustained long-term success that we noted through our data. Proximal obstructions, however, are more likely to fail and are better candidates for DCR. And it's important to identify these during irrigation and IM endoscopy in the OR. Thank you. And thank you, Dr. Delgadio.
Thank you. Our next presentation is inferior turbinate submucosal resection. Does the addition of bone removal improve outcomes? By Dr. Kester from Syracuse, New York.
Hi, my name is Lindsay Kester, and I'm a second-year medical student at SUNY Upstate, and I'm going to be talking to you this morning about inferior turbinate surgery. Nasal obstruction is a common presenting symptom in patients with nasal complaints, and inferior turbinate hypertrophy is a common contributor to this symptom. And patients who have symptoms that are refractory to medical management often choose to undergo surgical intervention, and inferior turbinate surgery is typically performed in this context. So there are a variety of surgical techniques for this inferior turbinate hypertrophy, and they range from minimally invasive options like outfracture and submucosal soft tissue reduction to more extensive options, which include removal of parts or all of the inferior turbinate bone. And today, I'm going to be talking to you about submucosal soft tissue reduction and submucosal bone resection. At our institution, we prefer methods of submucosal resection. And so here we wanted to assess outcomes in patients undergoing different degrees of this submucosal resection. So we looked at outcomes in two groups of patients. So the first group underwent the more extensive soft tissue and bone resection, and the second group underwent soft tissue resection alone. A retrospective review was conducted using medical records from a database of one surgeon. 81 patients were included in the study, and 50 patients underwent soft tissue and bone resection, and 31 patients underwent soft tissue resection alone. In order to assess outcomes, we use the Nasal Obstruction Symptom Evaluation, or NOES scale. And the NOES scale is a validated instrument designed for outcomes assessment in patients with nasal obstruction. As you can see, the NOES scale asks 5 questions related to symptoms of nasal obstruction, like congestion and trouble breathing. Patients are asked to rate their symptoms on a scale from 0 to 4. The aggregate score is then multiplied by 5 for a range of scores from 0 to 100. And next, I'd like to talk through some of the differences in the surgical techniques in these two different procedures. So I'm going to show you a video starting with the submucosal soft tissue resection. So here you can see a very prominent right inferior turbinate. And what we're going to do first is to infiltrate that turbinate with an anesthetic solution containing epinephrine. And we can do this along several different aspects of the turbinate. And so what we do next is to use a turbinate blade to make a stab incision along the anterior aspect of the turbinate, which you can see right here. And then the tip of the dissecting blade is used to elevate a submucosal flap. And what we do next is to direct the cutting face of the microdebrider medially to resect some of this redundant soft tissue. And this is done along various aspects of the turbinate. We do try to treat the entire turbinate during this procedure. And here you can see that the turbinate has been reduced in size. And the next portion of the procedure involves first infracture, which you can see here, and then outfracture of the turbinate. And you can see that the nasal airway has become much more patent after this procedure. So the next procedure that I'd like to talk about is submucosal bone resection. And here, the incision has already been made. You can see a submucosal subperiosteal dissection previously was medial to the inferior turbinate bone. Now we're dissecting laterally. And a suction elevator is now being used to dissect away the soft tissue more posteriorly. And now we're going circumferentially around this inferior turbinate bone. And so now forceps are being used to remove the turbinate bone. You can see that the turbinate has become reduced in size. And so now we're using a microdebrider to, again, resect some of this redundant soft tissue as we did in the other procedure. And so here anteriorly and now inferiorly along the length of the inferior turbinate. And you just saw out fracture of this turbinate. And again, you can see that the nasal airway is much more patent during this procedure. So we began our analysis by evaluating differences in baseline characteristics between the two groups. And as you can see, the two groups were found to be in concordance across categories of age, gender, and concurrent procedures. Next, we assessed outcomes using the raw scores within each of the two groups. So in the soft tissue and bone group, the mean preoperative score was 74.3. The mean postoperative score was 25, and this difference was found to be significant. In soft tissue group, the mean preoperative score was 68. The mean postoperative score was 32. And again, this difference was also found to be significant. Now, in order to account for differences in baseline status, we chose to assess differences in NOES improvement between the two groups on a percentage basis. So as you can see, the soft tissue and bone resection group had a 65% NOES improvement, whereas the soft tissue group had a 43% improvement. And this difference was found to be significant. So as you can see from our results, the addition of bone resection does result in improved outcomes. And So why might that be? Well, the additional bone resection does provide for a greater degree of volume change in the inferior turbinate, but in addition to that, the additional dissection in this group allows for greater and more thorough resection of the soft tissue along the inferior turbinate. And so you can see there's much better access in this image along the inferior aspect of that turbinate. And in the image on the right, you can see a much more patent nasal airway after this procedure. So in conclusion, our data support the existing findings that submucosal resection is an effective technique in improving symptoms of nasal obstruction. And most importantly, we find that the addition of bone resection to soft tissue resection results in superior symptom improvement in patients with nasal obstruction. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Our final paper is Validation and Limitation of Image-Guided Robotic Surgery for the Skull Base by Dr. Whiting from Norfolk, Virginia.
Good morning. I'd like to thank the Triologic Society for allowing me to present our research on validation and limitation of image-guided robotic surgery for the skull base. I'd like to thank my co-authors, Dr. Hahn and Dr. Strasnick. These are our disclosures. In discussing access to the skull base with a robotic surgical system, studies have been performed which demonstrated that there is limited view and access to the skull base secondary to its compact anatomy as well as the robotic arm dimensions. Prior cadaver models have required invasive approaches for robotic arm placement. In addition, robotic surgical systems have been previously evaluated with image guidance systems through two different forms: a kinematic image guidance system and an optical image guidance system. Kinematic image guidance has a tendency toward inaccuracy secondary to the mobility of the robotic joints, and the optical image guidance system, which tends to rely on rigid instrumentation, is inherently contradictory to the robot. To date, however, no studies have been performed which examine an electromagnetic image guidance system. So we set out to evaluate if a robotic surgical system can access the skull base, specifically the anterior, mid, and lateral skull base, and to establish if an electromagnetic image guidance system is compatible with a robotic surgical system, and if it is, to determine the accuracy. 7 cadaver heads were prepared and dissected prior to examination with the robot in the OR. We examined the anterior skull base through the following approaches. The mid-skull base, in addition to the above approaches, we added a sphenoidotomy and a trans-pterygopalatine fossa approach. And the lateral skull base was examined via middle cranial fossa approach. To examine the accuracy, surgical landmarks, we used titanium screws, which were placed in bilateral mastoid tips, zygomatic roots, lateral orbital rims, and the glabella. CT scans were then performed with a sinus protocol. And on this coronal image, you can see the left lateral orbital rim with a fiducial in place. We then made a custom electromagnetic probe with biomedically engineering to make it compatible with our robotic surgical system. We found that there is limited visualization and access by the robotic arms and endoscope to the skull base, and we had failure to access all skull base regions. However, we did achieve some limited access to the lateral skull base with one robotic arm and endoscope. This did require manual traction to assist the robot, and this was due to the operating surgeon not having any tactile feedback as to the retraction force necessary to retract the soft tissues. Surprisingly, the calibrated electromagnetic image guidance system probe worked when attached to the robotic surgical system. And I say surprisingly because at the onset of the study, there was some concerns that the ferromagnetic interference would result in poor calibration and error. The mean distance between anatomic landmarks to corresponding radiographic landmarks, or accuracy, was measured as 2.71 millimeters and a standard deviation of 0.84. The mean calculated calibration error for the image guidance system probe, or how distorted the probe was 2.78 with a standard deviation of 0.92. comparison of the registration error and accuracy showed a negative Pearson's correlation of negative 0.229. And this meant that poorer calibration tended toward higher inaccuracy, which made sense. This, however, did not reach statistical significance. In discussing access to the skull base, we were limited due to the flexibility of the distal robotic arms as well as crowding. The robotic arm can cause tissue damage due to lack of haptic feedback to the surgeon and the limited space of the skull base as well as visualization of the distal robotic arms away from the operating portion. Discussing accuracy, the electromagnetic image guidance system and robotic system can be integrated. However, the accuracy is not sufficient for clinical use at this time. Prior studies, and most surgeons would agree, that less than 2 millimeters of accuracy are needed to reliably use the image guidance in the operating room. And for lateral skull base work, less than 1 millimeter of accuracy would be preferred. Limitations of our study is that this is a small sample size. However, it does correlate and is comparable with prior studies that have been done using the robot to examine the skull base. The electromagnetic image guidance system probe for the robotic surgical system is in its initial experimental stages and needs further refinement to be used. In conclusion, the robotic surgical system cannot access the skull base in its current technology, and the robotic surgical system with electromagnetic image guidance system is compatible, but further study is necessary to improve its accuracy as well as to improve instrumentation. Going forward, the electromagnetic image guidance system appears to be the most appropriate medium for future robotic surgical system studies. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd first like to thank all the speakers for staying on time in a very tight schedule. And in the remaining few minutes we have, I'd like to open up the floor for questions for the presenters. If you're asking questions, please go to the microphones, and the presenters, please come to the front of the room. Any questions from the floor?
For the inferior meatal surgery, what specifically was done to the inferior meatus?
I'm John Delgadio, I'm the senior author. So what was done is basically with when pathology is identified in the inferior meatus, you get a bulging of the lateral wall, whether it's a cyst, whether it's significant mucosal edema. It's right there at Hasner's valve. So what can be done is basically a marsupialization. You open up the cyst or remove the edema, you leave the lateral wall untouched so you don't get a circumferential scar, but you can dissect up almost basically up to the inferior turbinate and open up the distal nasal lacrimal duct. And once you get to the inferior turbinate, you're in bone. So at the level of the attachment of the inferior turbinate. So for distal pathology, especially with cysts, and you'd be surprised how often you can find pathology inferior meatus. It's well over 90% of the time in patients with epiphora, in our experience. But it's a very simple surgery. If you followed up to the inferior turbinate and you still have significant mucosal edema inside the duct, those patients are more likely to fail. But when it stays in the inferior meatus, it's a very high success rate. Very simple surgery, actually.
John, can you stay there for one second? Can you describe your technique for inferior meatus endoscopy, if there are any particular techniques that you use, and any standardization of your exam?
Yeah, so basically I use a pediatric scope. So I don't use a 4 millimeter scope. I do if I can get away with it, but most times I'll try to use a 30 degree pediatric scope. I just anesthetize with topical spray, so either lidocaine or ponacaine, and a decongestant. If it's a real tight inferior meatus, then I'll put a pledget with anesthetic directly in the inferior meatus. It'll also decongest the lateral aspect of the inferior turbinate well. And you can get in there and see very well. It's very rare that you can't access the inferior meatus in the office.
Thank you.
John Blanche. I just want to applaud the UCSF group for looking at change rather than baseline numbers to clear up the fact that there really is a correlation between what we see with an endoscope and symptoms. My question on this and other studies too is, although the SNOT-22 was mentioned, why was the SNOT-22 not used? instead of the synaptoid.
Yeah, so the SNOT 20 was used primarily because that's the data that we had available. And at UCSF, we started using a new electronic medical record, and we're starting to tabulate now SNOT 22 data. And I think this actually would be better to be able to track severity of symptoms.
Okay, I think that's all the time we have. Thank you very much for your attention.